If you will, pull out the outlines you have in your bulletins and turn your Bibles to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32. In our first session on the modern Jewish state and Bible prophecy, we emphasized the basic fact that the Bible spoke of a regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment, specifically the judgment of the tribulation. And so this morning we're going to focus on the tribulation, a period of time that will fall upon the whole world in general. Will be specifically focused on God's plan and program for the people of Israel. In way of introduction, let's look at chapter 32, verse 8 and verse 9. Verse 8, when the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the children of men, he set the bounds of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. For Jehovah's portion is his people, Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. God has an overall prophetic program, which we often subdivide into three distinct plans, because God has a plan for Israel, he has a plan for the church, he has a plan for the Gentile nations. Now, regardless of whether we speak of God's plan for Israel, the church, or the Gentile nations, all three of God's plans focus around his plan and program for Israel. To the extent that Moses writes in these verses that when God providentially laid down will become the borders of various nations, that was somehow based upon the number of Jews that play a role in that nation's history. In verse 8, he calls God by the phrase Most High, and according to Genesis chapter 14, verses 18 through 20, whenever God is called the Most High, it emphasizes God as the possessor of the heavens and the earth. As the possessor of this earth, he has the right to subdivide the earth and give what portion of the earth to whatever people or tribe he chooses. When he did so and providentially laid down, become the borders of the USA, that was somehow based upon the number of Jews that play a role in American history. As verse 9 declares, Jehovah's portion is his people, and Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. Our focus this morning again is on the 7-year period called the Tribulation, a period of judgment will fall upon the whole world in general. But even that program, as we're about to see, centers around the Jewish people. And so our specific topic is the Jews and the tribulation. We'll cover this in four basic areas, primarily in the first three. We'll begin discussing how the Jewish people relate to the purposes of the tribulation. Secondly, we'll discuss how the Jews relate to the beginning or the start of the tribulation. And thirdly, we'll deal with the principle of the Jews in the tribulation, what happens to them during these 7 years. And that's what we'll spend most of our time on. We'll briefly touch the last point, the Jews and the end of tribulation, but those are two topics normally that cover two other studies. Then we'll simply summarize what they teach at the end. Let's begin then, Roman numeral 2, the Jews and the purposes of the tribulation. As your outline shows, the three major purposes for the tribulation, and the first one applies to both Jews and Gentiles equally, which is to make an end of wickedness and wicked ones. To make an end of wickedness and wicked ones. That applies to both Jews and Gentiles equally and goes beyond our purpose this morning. I will not develop this first purpose, but in your notes you have the passages where the purpose is found. Isaiah chapter 13, verse 9, and chapter 24, verses 19 and 20. Now, the second and third purpose have a direct relevance to God's program for Israel. For the second purpose, we'll look at the Revelation passage, Revelation chapter 7. The second purpose is to bring about a great worldwide revival. The purpose is stated in the Matthew 24, verse 14 passage, says that the gospel will be proclaimed throughout the whole world and to every nation before the end comes. And the one statement that Jesus makes in Matthew 24, 14 is not given a full chapter of exposition. Revelation 7, verses 1 through 8 provide us with the means of the proclamation and verses 9 through 17 with the results of it. The main purpose of Revelation is not to give us a lot of new prophetic information. And in fact, most, not all, but most of the material in the first 20 chapters is found throughout the Old Testament. The problem is it was scattered and is scattered throughout the Old Testament would have been impossible to gather all this material together and put it in chronological sequence. And so the main purpose of Revelation is to take many of these Old Testament prophecies and give us the sequence by which they will be fulfilled. And primarily the book focuses on the 7 years of tribulation from chapter 6 to chapter 18. Now chapter 6 through 9 deal with the events of the first half. Chapters 10 through 14 with the events of the middle. And chapters 15 through 18 with the events of the second half. So the events of chapter 7 occur in the first half, the first 3.5 years of the tribulation. And we'll begin our reading in verse 1. After this, I saw four angels standing in the four corners of the earth, that no wind should blow on the earth around the sea or upon any tree. And I saw another angel ascend from the sun rising, having the seal of the living God. He cried with a great voice to the four angels and was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, nor the sea, nor the trees, until we will have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. And I heard the number of them that were sealed, 144,000 sealed out of every tribe of the children of Israel. In verses 5, 6, 7, 8, go on to list 12 tribes. We are told that 12,000 are selected from these 12 tribes, giving us the grand total of 144,000 Jews. And by means of the 144,000 Jews, the gospel will be proclaimed to all nations around the world. Now, looking at this from a purely human perspective, if I wish to conduct a worldwide revival in a short period of time, like 3.5 years, I could not think of a better group of people to use than Jewish people. Coming from me, that might not sound all that objective. Let me see if I can back it up a bit. If you survey the mission world today, you soon discover the vast majority of missionaries around the world come from the English-speaking world, and the vast majority of them specifically from the USA. If you interview these missionaries to see how much time they have to go through training, after becoming believers, they have to think in terms of 3 or 4 years of Bible Institute, Bible College, or seminary. And while they are then ready to proclaim the word in an English-speaking context, not quite ready to do so in a country that speaks a different tongue, the next 2 to 4 years must be spent in language study. They will need to learn the language to communicate the gospel in. The average American missionary in the foreign field has spent a minimum of 6 years or more in training before he's comfortably proclaiming the word. These events occur in 3.5 years, and there's simply not that much time to play with, and that's where there is a distinctive advantage in using Jewish people. To begin with, the Jews are scattered throughout the world. As a result of this scattering, most of the world's major languages and a great number of the world's minor languages are spoken by some Jews somewhere. Furthermore, with the American Jew being the exception to the rule, most Jews around the world are at least bilingual, speaking 2 or more languages fluently. I speak 2 languages, but both my parents speak 5 languages. My father's passed away, my mother's still living. If she was to become a believer, she could witness in 5 different tongues without first undergoing language training. And also, here again, the American Jew is the exception to the rule. Most Jewish people receive a basic knowledge of the Old Testament. It's part of their training curriculum. So after God will rapture the church from the world, he will proceed to save 144,000 Jews. They already speak the languages which are necessary. They already have a basic knowledge of the Old Testament. All they may need then is, say, the 10 basic steps of Campus Crusade for Christ. For New Testament knowledge, and very quickly they can begin to proclaim the word throughout the world. Essentially, that's what's going to happen. And by means of 144,000 Jews, he will proclaim the gospel to all the nations around the world. But when we witness, we soon learn that the presentation of the gospel is one thing, the reception of it is quite another. So what will be the reception of the message? Verse 9. After these things, after what things? After 144,000, I saw and behold a great multitude, which no man could number, out of every nation and of all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, arrayed in white robes and palms in their hands. Skip down to verse 13. And one of the elders answered, saying unto me, these who are arrayed in the white robes, who are they and whence came they? And I say unto him, my Lord, you know. And he said to me, these are they that come out of the great tribulation, and they washed the robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. The next thing John sees is myriads of Gentiles standing before the throne of God, Gentiles who have come out of every nation, every people, every tribe, every language group. And the question is raised as to the identity of so many Gentiles before the throne. The answer is, these are Gentiles who have come out as believers from the tribulation, for they washed the robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. As a result of the preaching of 144,000 Jews, myriads of Gentiles will come to faith. In this manner, God will fulfill the second major purpose to bring about a worldwide revival. Now, for the third purpose, we'll turn to the book of Daniel, chapter 12. The third purpose is to break in pieces the will of the holy people. Now, in chapter 11 of his book, Daniel has been given a vision in which he could see what conditions would be like for his people, the Jewish people, during the tribulation. And the vision that begins in chapter 11 continues into chapter 12 and then terminates with verse 4. Then in verse 5, a question will be raised as to just how long will these terrible days for Israel be allowed to continue? And when the answer is given, he will give us the third purpose. Daniel chapter 12, verse 5. The night Daniel looked, and behold, there stood at the tomb, the one on the brink of the river on this side, the other on the brink of the river on that side. And one said to a man clothed in linen was above the walls of the river, how long will it be to the end of these wonders? And I heard the man clothed in linen was above the walls of the river, when he held up his right hand and left hand unto heaven, and swore by him to this river, that shall be for a time, times and a half. And now notice. And when they made an end of breaking in pieces the will of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. These terrible days of judgment must continue until finally the stubborn will of the holy people is broken, until they finally cease trying to establish their own righteousness and seek the righteousness of God through Jesus the Messiah. Now, while Daniel chapter 12, verse 7 gives us the third purpose, the next passage on your outline, Ezekiel chapter 20, will give us the means by which this purpose will be accomplished. Ezekiel chapter 20. Now we dealt with this passage on Friday evening, so I won't read the passage again. And I'll just simply summarize some points we made earlier. But in this passage, Ezekiel draws a simile with the Exodus. At the Exodus, God brought the people out of Egypt. And after they received the Mosaic law and built a tabernacle into the land because of many murmurings, when they rebelled for the tenth time, God withdrew the offer of the promised land from the Exodus generation. They're now under judgment and had to wander the desert till everyone who came out of Egypt died out, except for those below the age of 20 and the two good spies. So 40 years later was a brand new generation, a brand new nation, a nation that was born as freemen in the desert, not born as slaves in Egypt, that could enter land under Joshua. And that becomes the historical frame of reference for something future. But now he says he will begin to gather the Jewish people from all parts of the world. The regard we've been seeing with the present Jewish state, where Jews have come from 90 different nations. But this is the regathering as we notify the night in unbelief in preparation for the tribulation judgments. And at some point you will once again enter into judgment. And by means of the tribulation judgments in verse 38, the rebels will be purged out. And those who survive in verse 37 will be brought into the bond of the covenant, the new covenant. And so it's going to be a new nation, a regenerate and saved nation, though then able to enter land under King Messiah for the final restoration. But by means of the tribulation judgments, God intends to break the will of the holy people. And we can redefine the third purpose to be to bring about Israel's national salvation, to bring about Israel's national regeneration. Insofar as the three major purposes of the tribulation, two of these directly relevant to God's plan and program for the Jewish people. Now go to page 2. We'll now go on to our second point, the Jews and the beginning of the tribulation. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 9. This is a passage we looked at on our Friday night study, so I will be summarizing some things. But in verses 24 through 27, the prophet is being given his famous vision of the 77s, a vision of a 490-year period God has decreed over the Jewish people. When you arrive at the end of verse 26, you learn that the first 483 years of this 490-year period has already been fulfilled in history, coming to an end at the time of the first coming. But there's still 7 years left to run of this prophetic time clock of Israel, the same 7 years we now call the tribulation. And now the question is this: what will be the singular event to begin the 7 years of tribulation taking away? And that brings us to verse 27. And he shall make a firm covenant with many for 1:7. And we noted on Friday night that the pronoun he goes back to its narrowest antecedent, which is the phrase, the prince that shall come in verse 26. In other words, the prince that shall come in verse 26 and that he who makes a covenant in verse 27 is the one, the same individual that in our circles today is simply the Antichrist. And he uses a definite article, the prince that shall come, because he spoke of him twice before in Daniel 7 and Daniel 8. And the point is this: the tribulation begins with the signing of a 7-year treaty between Israel and the Antichrist. As we noted the last night in the rapture discussion, it will not be the rapture itself that will begin the tribulation. The Bible clearly does teach us, we saw, the rapture will occur sometime before the tribulation starts. Maybe just before, maybe 10, 20, 30 years before. We simply do not know how long before. But the starting point of the tribulation will not be the rapture. It will be the signing of this covenant. Until this covenant is signed, the tribulation cannot begin. Now, this presupposes there are two things in place before the covenant could be signed. One is and one is not. First of all, this presupposes there is a Jewish state with a Jewish government with whom a covenant like this could be signed. And we've had such a state since 1948. The second thing this presupposes that the Antichrist will be in high authority before the tribulation, with whom a sovereign state like Israel will sign a covenant of this nature, and that issue is not yet in place. Now, note three other things in this verse. First of all, the covenant is made with many, but not with all. There will be a segment of the Jewish population that reject having any involvement with the covenant. It is made with many. The many would have to include the Israeli leaders in power to make such a covenant, but it will not be made with all. Secondly, the covenant is intended to last for 7 years, but it won't last 7 years. At the midpoint, it will be broken. And then thirdly, the breaking of the covenant will cause abominations and desolations to fall upon the Jewish people. Now, the covenant that inaugurates the tribulation as viewed by Daniel 9:27 is viewed here from a human perspective. And from a human viewpoint, it will be viewed as a 7-year treaty that would not last as long as it was intended to. The next passage in your outline, Isaiah 28, will give us God's perspective on the same covenant that triggers the tribulation. Isaiah 28. Isaiah chapter 28, he begins in verse 14, informing us of his viewpoint of the many who make the covenant. Wherefore, hear the word of Jehovah, ye scoffers that rule this people that is in Jerusalem. And God's viewpoint is to call them scoffers or fools. And that's because of God's perspective on the covenant in verse 15. Because ye have said, we've made a covenant with death, at which ye all are in agreement. And when the ever-flowing skirt shall pass through, it will not come unto us. We made lies our refuge under falsehood, have we hidden ourselves. That's in verse 15 that we discover the actual reason why Israel bothers to make such a covenant. Now, the Bible does use many symbols, but the Bible is consistent in its usage of symbols. Any one symbol will mean the same thing through both testaments in about 95% of the cases. There's a 5 percentile category where a symbol is used more than one way, but 95% it's used the same way through both testaments. For example, whenever the word stone is used symbolically, it's always a symbol of the Messiah. Whenever the word mountain is used symbolically, it's always a symbol of a king or kingdom or throne. Whenever the word star is used symbolically, it symbolizes an angel. Whenever the word cloud is used symbolically, it symbolizes God's glory. Whenever the figure of a flood is used symbolically, it symbolizes a military invasion. We have that figure used here in verse 15, the overflowing scourge, the overflowing flood. The word security is by far the most important single word in Israeli foreign policy. Israel has had to fight four major wars with the Arab states over the issue of Israeli security. The bombing of the Iraqi nuclear by Israel was over the issue of Israeli security. The war against the PLO in Lebanon was over the issue of Israeli security. Negotiations that are coming on and off at the present time always focus on Israeli security. But situations will arise in the future that the Israeli leadership will come to feel the only hope they have of gaining this security is by making this covenant with the Antichrist. There's a common misconception they'll accept the Antichrist as the Messiah. The Bible nowhere says this, and they will not accept him as the Messiah. They simply make a covenant with him that guarantees Israel's military security, and they put their trust in this covenant for their security, and God says, "You're fools for thinking so." This is not a covenant of heaven, but of hell, not of life, but of death. And the same three things we saw in Daniel 9:27, we see here. First of all, in verse 16, for example, read of the non-many that refuse to have anything to do with the covenant. And there will be a segment. And the segment that rejects the covenant, notice that those who put their faith in the stone, and the stone used symbolically, is the Messiah. Secondly, in Daniel 9:27, the covenant was broken. The same thing happens here in verse 18. Your covenant with death will be annulled. Your agreement with Sheol will not stand. And when the overflowing skirt shall pass through, then you shall be trodden down by it. As in Daniel 9:27, so here, the covenant will be broken, it will be annulled. In place of being exempt from further military problems, they now become subject to it. The third thing in Daniel 9:27 was that the breaking of the covenant will result in desolations falling upon the Jewish people. The same thing happens here in verse 19. As often as it passes through, will take you. For morning by morning it shall pass through. By day and by night it shall be nothing but terror to understand the message. For the bed is shorter than a man can stretch himself out on it, and the covering narrower, he can wrap himself in it. They made the covenant for reasons of security and comfort. When it is broken, they will get a strong measure of insecurity and discomfort. And the picture of extreme discomfort is given two illustrations in verse 20. First, it's like trying to stretch yourself out on the bed, but this bed is simply too short for you. Or secondly, trying to wrap yourself up in the blanket and give yourself protection from the cold, but the blanket is too small to cover all of you. Now, being a 5'4" Jewish kid, I've never had this first experience. I have no idea what it must feel like to stretch myself out in a bed and not succeed. Every time I try to do so, I have succeeded admirably. Some problems you don't have when you're 5'4". Now, as I mentioned previously, periodically I lead the special 5-week-long study tours of Israel. And in the tour that led back in 1978, there was a professional basketball player with the San Antonio Spurs. He was just under 7 feet tall. The only Philistine ever came on one of my trips like this. And because in Israel they make beds for my size people more than once at breakfast, he would complain to me about a very uncomfortable night because he was not able to stretch himself out on the bed. I had no way of identifying myself with his trials and tribulations whatsoever. Some problems you do not have when you're 5'4". I have had the second experience when I was still a student at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. It was January 1967. About 5 to 6 months before the Six-Day War, and those of us majoring in historical geography and archaeology were given some time off to do some practical work in the archaeology field. And the old Judean border back then cut into heartland of present-day Israel. As for reasons of security, we had to spend each night at a military encampment. And the Negev desert can be quite warm during the day, but it can also get miserably cold at night. And the blanket I was issued the first night was even too small for a 5'4" Jewish kid. As I tried to keep my feet warm, my nose would freeze. As I tried to warm my nose up, my feet would get cold. And all night long, the story kept repeating itself. Falling asleep, waking up, because that stupid blanket just wouldn't cover all of me. And not of insecurity, not of discomfort. Verse 21, for Jehovah rises up as in Mount Perazim, he'll be wroth in the valley of Gibeon, that he may do his work, his strange work, and bring to pass his act, his strange act. Now therefore be ye not scoffers, lest your bonds be made strong for him. A decree of destruction have I heard from the Lord, Jehovah hosts upon the whole earth. As a result of the signing of the covenant here on earth, God will issue this decree of destruction against the whole earth. And this decree of destruction is the same as the seven sealed scroll of Revelation chapters 5 and 6. As each seal is broken, there is a massive destruction of the earth's surface and a massive destruction of the earth's population. And by the time these 7 years have run their course, somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of the earth's surface would be destroyed, an equal percentage of the earth's population. But again, God issues this decree of destruction only as a result of the signing of the covenant. So insofar as the beginning of the tribulation cannot and will not begin until there's a signing of the seven-year covenant. The third thing for our study this morning is the Jews in the tribulation. Let's look at Jeremiah chapter 30. At this point, the Bible has a lot of detail. Many passages throughout the Word of God detail this aspect. For the time element that we're dealing with, we'll limit ourselves to these four passages. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 4. Now these are the words that Jehovah spake concerning Israel, concerning Judah. For thus says Jehovah, we've heard a voice so trembling and the fear not of peace. Ask ye now and see where the man does travail with child. Wherefore do I see every man with his hands and his loins as human in travail, and all faces are turned into paleness. Alas, for that day is grace, so there is none like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. Again, the Bible gives us many different names for the tribulation. Here is a name that directly relates it to Jewish people. It is called the time of Jacob's trouble. For while it is very true that everybody in the tribulation will suffer, the Jewish people will suffer more so. And that's because of a principle found in Isaiah chapter 40, verses 1 and 2. Isaiah 40, verses 1 and 2 teaches, Israel receives double for her sins. When God punishes the Gentiles, he'll punish them this much. Israel will be punished this much. And because Israel sees double for her sins, the tribulation becomes uniquely the time of Jacob's trouble. How much more they suffer, we'll see the next three passages. Before leaving this one, notice also contains a promise. No matter how bad they might get for the Jewish people as a people will survive it. Now we'll go to the second passage, Matthew 24. Matthew 24, verse 15. When therefore you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let them that reads understand. Then let them in Judea flee into the mountains. Let him that is on the housetop not go down to take out the thing which are in his house. Let him that is in the field not return back to take his cloak. But woe unto them that are with child, them that give suck in those days, and pray that your flight be not a winter, neither on a Sabbath, for then shall be great tribulation, such as hath not been from the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall be. And except those days have been shortened, no flesh would have been saved, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened. In verse 15, Jesus gives a warning sign to Jewish people living in the midpoint of the tribulation, that when they see the abomination of desolation, that will be the point of time the Antichrist will break a seven-year covenant, take over the Jewish temple, seat himself in it, proclaim himself to be God Almighty, call upon the whole world to worship him as God, and to signify their acceptance of his deity of taking the mark of 666. When they hear of this event, they must get out of Israel and get out of Israel quickly. And the whole tenor of the passage is on the need for speed and haste without a single second to lose. If they happen to be on the housetop for any reason, they must not come off the house to go inside to take any possessions. As soon as the foot touches the ground, they must make their way out of the country. And if this they happen to be plowing in the field and hear of this event taking place, they must not go back to the kibbutz living quarters to take even a coat. But from the place where they're plowing, they must get out of that country and get out quickly. And the whole tenor, again, the speed and haste, without even a single second to lose. Because at this point, worldwide anti-Semitism breaks out in full force. And Satan begins his final program of total Jewish annihilation, signaled by the abomination of desolation. And therefore, the modern Jewish state will collapse at the midpoint of tribulation. There'll be one more forced exile from the land, mostly in the area of the Middle East countries, a short exile of 3.5 years, ultimately bring them to national salvation. In verse 20, two prayer requests are urged, that when this event occurs, pray won't happen either in the winter or on a Sabbath day. Now, it seldom ever snows in Israel. What would the problem be with winter? And there are several differences between the state of Israel and the United States. And one of these differences is the weather pattern. Here in America, we receive rain all four seasons. Rain falls on this land, summer, fall, winter, and spring. Not so in Israel, where the rain season begins at the end of October. Rain will fall the months of November, December, January, February, will begin to peter out in March and die out in mid-April. So from mid-April to mid-October, no rain falls. Another difference is the way highways are built. When Americans build a highway and come to a water gully, even if it's a dry water gully, the American way is to build a bridge across it. Not so in Israel, where the roads were paved into the water gullies and up out again. Technically, these gullies are called wadis, W-A-D-I. A wadi is dry all of summer, it's also dry most of winter. But during the winter months when rain falls along the mountain ranges of Israel, water begins rushing down these wadis with tremendous force, carrying tons of rock and debris, often destroying these highways. On more than one occasion, when living in Israel, I would have to make a major detour to go back to where I came from because the wadi had destroyed a highway just that way. Israelis like to hike these wadis because they're rather picturesque, look at miniature Grand Canyons, often hiking into the fall months, not realizing the rain season had begun. It may not be raining where they happen to be walking, but it has begun raining elsewhere, and suddenly rains come down. And every fall in newspapers in Israel, reports of Israelis killed that way. Then when the Jews flee the land, they'll have to flee by means of these wadis. If this happens in the winter, it'll make escape that much more dangerous. How dangerous it could be was made vivid a few years ago when there were 40 French tourists walking down a wadi heading for an archaeological site. It was not raining where they were walking, but they began raining elsewhere. And within 30 minutes, 38 of these 40 French tourists drowned, only two survived. So pray that your flight be not in winter. Secondly, don't pray won't happen the Sabbath. What's the problem with the Sabbath? because on the Sabbath day in Israel, from sundown Friday till sundown Saturday, all public transportation closes down. No trains, no buses are running. Unless you have your own automobile, it would make escape that much more difficult. The last census, only about 30% of the Jewish population in Israel own their own cars, and the rest are dependent upon public transportation, which is non-existent upon the Sabbath day. So pray that your flight be not on the Sabbath. But the picture here is the Jewish people now fleeing the land as the state collapses, falling again under Gentile authority. But the exile will finally bring them to salvation. Now turn to Revelation 12. Revelation 12 describes the events that occurred at the midpoint of the tribulation. As often in this book, he builds on what was in the Old Testament. So he begins with a historical summary in chapter 12, verses 1 through 5. In verses 1 and 2, he sees a vision of a woman arrayed with the sun, moon, and stars, all of which harks back to Joseph's dream of Genesis chapter 37, verses 9 through 11, Genesis 37, 9 through 11, from which we learn the sun represents Jacob, the moon is Rachel, the 12 stars are the 12 sons of Jacob who fathered the 12 tribes of Israel. And so this woman throughout this chapter represents the people of Israel, the Jewish people, portrayed as a woman because in the Old Testament, Israel is the wife of Jehovah. But a certain point in history, which is just before the birth of the Messiah, just before the first coming, at this point in verse 3 and 4, Satan gathers all of his demonic forces in and around the land of Israel to try to thwart the purpose of the first coming. The first attempt was made with the slaughter of the babes of Bethlehem, but throughout his life there were many times they tried to kill him, either prematurely at the wrong time, other time than Passover, in the wrong way, like by sword or by stoning. All such attempts failed with the statement, his hour was not yet come. But his hour eventually did come. He died at the proper time, in the proper way. The atonement was made. And in verse 5, the child was caught up to God's throne when he ascended from the Mount of Olives. So in 5 verses, we're given a quick summary of the entire life of Jesus from just before his birth until his ascension. And the purpose to show why Satan hates the Jews, he hates the Jews because they produce the Messiah. But in verse 6, we find ourselves in the same place we're at in Matthew 24. And the woman fled into wilderness, where she had a place prepared of God, that there they may nourish her 1,260 days. As in Matthew 24, so in verse 6, the woman Israel is fleeing. Now, Matthew 24, she flees to the mountains. Here in verse 6, she flees to the wilderness or desert, and to a place prepared in advance, a pre-existing place. And there she hides for the second half of the tribulation for 3.5 years. Well, verse 6 spells out doom and flees. It doesn't tell us why. That's explained by verses 7 through 12. At the midpoint of the tribulation, Satan will be expelled from his present abode, the atmospheric heavens. He'll be confined to the earth for the second half of the tribulation. And he will lose the free access he has into heaven for the purpose of accusing the brethren. And there'll be two results when Satan is confined in verse 12. The first result is that heaven will rejoice. The second result for the earth is the opposite. He says, woe for the earth and for the sea, because the devil has gone down unto you having great wrath, knowing he had but a short time. And once he's confined to the earth, he knows his time is short, only 3.5 years before the second coming. And knowing his time is short, he is full of wrath, very angry. Now what will he be doing with the wrath? And now notice how verses 13 and 14 bring together the thoughts of verse 6 and verse 12. And when the dragon saw that he was cast down to the earth, he persecuted the woman that brought forth the man-child. And there were given to the woman the two wings of the great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness unto a place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent. The woman is fleeing because Satan has begun his worldwide persecution of the Jewish people. And for that reason, she flees to a pre-existing place. Now, to what extent will Satan's goal to not only the Jews succeed in the tribulation? Turn now to Zechariah chapter 13. If you're not familiar with the order of the minor prophets, Zechariah will be the second book from the back of the Old Testament. The last book is the Italian prophet, Malachi. Just go past the Malachi papers. You see Zechariah chapter 13. Zechariah 13, verse 8. Zechariah 13, verse 8. And it shall come to pass in all the land, says Jehovah, two parts therein shall be cut off and thine, but the third shall be left therein. Now bring the third part into the fire. I will refine them as silver is refined. I will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. And I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, Jehovah is my God. To what extent will the persecutions of the second half of the tribulation be successful? According to Zechariah, two-thirds of the Jewish population living when the tribulation starts will simply not survive it. Under Nazism, one-third of the Jewish population died. Under the Antichrist, inspired by Satan, two-thirds will die. But the one-third is left, and they are the key element in the role of the Jews and the end of the tribulation. As far as Cap believe, there will be four separate groups of Jews in the tribulation. The first group are the ones we spoke of earlier, the 144,000 Jews would be the ones evangelizing the world. The second group are the simply calling other Jewish believers, Jews who are saved throughout the tribulation but not part of the 144,000 figure. The third group being called the apostate Jews. They comprise approximately two-thirds of the Jewish population of that day. They are the many who enter the covenant with the Antichrist, and they'll be primarily the ones who will die off in the persecutions of the second half. And the fourth group we call the faithful remnant. This will comprise approximately one-third of the Jewish population. They go through the 7 years, unbelievers as far as Jesus is concerned, both unbelievers as far as the Antichrist is concerned. These are the non-many that will not go along with the covenant. They'll be the ones that will succeed in escaping to the mountains of Matthew 24 and the wilderness of Revelation 12. And the Armageddon will be organized specifically to annihilate the one-third remnant still living. Let me briefly mention the last 2 points under Roman numeral 5, how the Jews relate to the end of the tribulation. Normally in a different type of series, I do a separate study on each of these titles. Let's first of all deal with calculate the basis of the second coming. This is one of the key differences between the rapture of the church and the second coming. The rapture has no preconditions whatsoever. It can happen in a moment of time. But the actual second coming does have a specific precondition, and that is Israel's national salvation. Until the Jewish people as a people are saved, there'll be no second coming. You'll find this in let me give you 5 passages just to mark down for your notes. You'll find this Leviticus chapter 26, verses 40 through 42. Leviticus 26, verses 40 through 42. Jeremiah chapter 3, verses 11 through 18. Jeremiah 3, 11 through 18. Hosea chapter 5, verse 15 through chapter 6, verse 3. Hosea chapter 5, verse 15 through chapter 6, verse 3. Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10 through chapter 13, verse 1. Zechariah 12, 10 through 13, 1. And Matthew chapter 23, verses 37 through 39. Matthew 23, 37 through 39. The precondition to the second coming involves two elements. First of all, Israel will have to confess the national sin of rejecting the Messiah. But secondly, they must plead for him to return, to mourn for him as one mourns for only son. Until these two things occur, there will be no second coming. Now, according to the Hosea passage I gave you, in the closing days of tribulation, in connection with the campaign of Armageddon, the Jewish leaders will finally recognize what they have to do. They'll issue a call to national repentance. And once that call is issued, that will trigger the last 3 days before the second coming. Now, for the first two of these last 3 days, they will confess the national sin of rejecting the Messiahship of Jesus. And the words they will use when they confess their sin will be Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 9. Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 9. On the third day, the whole nation will come to faith. Isaiah chapter 66, verse 8. Isaiah 66, 8 says they'll be born in one day. Zechariah chapter 3, verse 9. Zechariah 3, 9. He'll remove the iniquity of the land in one day. Romans 11, verse 26. Romans 11, 26. All Israel will be saved. On the third day, they will then plead for the Messiah to return, fulfilling the second part, the basis of the second coming. And the words of the pleading are found in Isaiah 64, Psalm 79, Psalm 80. Isaiah 64, Psalm 79, and Psalm 80. As a result of Israel's pleading, the Lord Jesus will return, defeat Israel's enemies, and establish the Messianic kingdom. And so the second coming will occur as a result of Israel's national salvation. And that in turn will bring about Israel's final restoration. But that's our topic for the evening study. So we'll conclude with this, and we'll have one more study this evening.